Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yep.
And NPR.
Kelly, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right. So we're just doing this because...
Because that article you wrote was so one of the most amazing things that we've ever read.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and today, a story about a decision.
About a decision that we, as human beings, we've only recently begun to consider.
Yeah.
Sure, there are stories like this elsewhere, but somehow...
Not too many.
Yeah, maybe not.
No. So we're going to devote the entire hour to just this one story, which I think is a first for us.
I think it is. And the story comes to us from a woman named Kelly Benham.
Okay.
She's a reporter for the Tampa Bay Times in Florida. Maybe the way to do this is chronologically, just sort of across time. Where were you and who, what did you want to do?
When I decided to have a baby?
Yeah.
Were you one of those people who ever since you were young, you knew that you would be a mom?
Yeah, I did. But I wasn't like, I didn't play with a lot of dolls or babysit. But I always just kind of had this weird certainty that I'd have a daughter.
Hmm. And a daughter and not a son.
Maybe a son too, but I don't know. I think I always thought I would have a daughter. And I sort of had this image of her in my head.
And what was the image?
Like really feisty, mischievous, dark hair, dirty face.
Okay, well, we've left princess land now.
Not a princess at all. A tree climber and a dog chaser. I really wanted to have a baby. I wanted one very badly.
But I just couldn't see how it made sense for me to be the father.
That's Tom French, also a journalist at the Tampa Bay Times, or he was at the time. He and Kelly had been dating for a few years, but he was a good 10 years older than her.
I had two kids.
Sons.
Approaching the end of college, and I was ready to travel. I wanted to see Spain and Greece. And
the world tour on the cruise ship where you get to be the poker master or whatever your secret fantasy.
No, the only world tour I would have been interested in was Springsteen.
Springsteen.
Following Springsteen around Europe. I'd made up my mind.
No more kids.
But she was insistent.
Oh, I stuck to it.
She saw our daughter very clearly.
Oh, yeah.
And saw that I was destined to be that little girl's father.
And was that a happy, gentle disagreement or the other kind?
Oh, it was brutal. We broke up and we worked at the same place. There was kind of an invisible line in the newsroom that neither of us would cross.
The line was the mailboxes.
There really was a line. Wow.
Yep.
It was a horrible time. We call it the dark era.
The dark period.
What turned you?
It was the Halloween section of Target. My sons and I have loved Halloween forever. I loved it when I was a little kid, and I just wanted to see what they had, if they had anything new, because I had, I usually check out their gargoyles and their stuff, and so I just was kind of walking through the section.
Browsing.
And then something just stopped me in my tracks.
Apparently it was really like kind of a lightning bolt epiphany.
And I just said, wait a minute, maybe you are not thinking about this straight. You're acting as though you're 80. And then it hit me that nobody knows how much time they have. To have a child is to embrace a future that you can't control.
Remember those words.
So I had this come to Jesus meeting with myself among the gargoyles. And that was when I realized I needed to just take a step back and try to restart the conversation with Kelly.
And so then he, went home and wrote me this long letter. And I was over him by that point. I was like, I wasn't looking back. So, over a few months.
Took a little while.
They patched things up, eventually got married, and started trying to make a baby.
We thought that this would just happen right away. And then, of course, it didn't.
After trying and trying.
The regular way.
She took.
Drugs that make you drop a bunch of eggs at one time.
After that.
The turkey baster method. There's like kind of a process that they walk you through.
After turkey baster.
IVF.
Test tube stuff.
Yeah. And I never thought that it would get that far.
But it would go farther because after trying IVF.
Three times.
That didn't work.
So they said, well, you can try it with an egg donor.
Meaning you get a friend who'd be willing to donate the egg, take the egg, put it in a dish, forcefully impregnate it with Tom's sperm, then you insert the egg into your womb.
And that's kind of the magic bullet, it seems, in fertility. It's kind of like, If you don't know what's wrong with your car, you just replace the whole engine.
Kelly asked a good friend to be an egg donor. They implanted the egg. And shortly after, she took a pregnancy test.
I tested way too early. And so the line was super, super faint. Wasn't even sure I could see it at all. So I took a photograph of the pregnancy test and I put it into Photoshop. And I actually had to dial up the contrast to make the the line appear.
That is, everything about this is so high tech.
Right?
Wow. And did you see what you wanted to see?
Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, I think there's two lines there. So I waited and I did it a second time. And then I told Tom.
And did you go into like the expectant parent mode? And
oh yeah. I touched up to paint, you know, I patched the little holes in the wall. Everything was perfect. Everything was absolutely perfect until it wasn't.
5 months into her pregnancy, 20 weeks, which is just about halfway because a full term is 40, Kelly was at a park playing with her dog.
And I felt a little bit weird and just started to bleed. Like, not a lot, but any amount of blood is not a good thing. And I called the doctor's office, and they didn't seem too concerned. They were like, yeah, you probably want to go to the hospital and get that checked.
And I went to pick her up, and by the time we got to the hospital, she was in a lot of pain.
Cramping, cramping, cramping. I knew something was really, really wrong. They got me into one of those wheelchairs, and they wheeled me into the sort of triage room. And by that point, like, blood was just coming out of me. Chunks of blood coming out of me. And I didn't know. I thought it was baby parts, like, falling out. And I thought, I'm having a miscarriage. Like, the baby's going to drop out on the floor. I was throwing up. And then the doctor came in, and he looked scared.
Does the doctor say something, or what happens?
The doctor explained to me quietly there was something that was making it difficult to stop Kelly's bleeding. And if they couldn't stop it, we might lose Kelly. And Kelly heard the doctor say this. And I need to tell you, Kelly is the toughest, most fearless person I've ever known. But she grabbed my arm as hard as anyone has ever grabbed my arm.
And I remember just asking him, don't let me die.
Please don't let me die. It was terrifying.
And then at some point, they brought in an ultrasound machine to see what was going on with the baby. And I assumed the baby was long dead. I mean, I thought there were baby parts on the floor. I didn't know. And they hooked up this machine and they were moving the wand around and around and trying to pick up a heartbeat, and there was nothing. And I was apologizing to Tom. I'm sorry. Like, you know, I just knew the baby was gone. Then all of a sudden, there it was, just this heartbeat.
This is sound she recorded on her cell phone.
Baby's heart's beat super, super fast, so it sounds like a rabbit or something.
You just hear it on the sonogram?
Yeah, this heartbeat pops up, and then there's the baby, and you can see it, and she looks fine. She's totally oblivious. She's just right there. So now I thought, oh my God, I'm gonna watch her die. I'm gonna watch her die in front of me. And then they started just pumping me full of drugs to try to get this labor stopped. There's this drug called magnesium sulfate, and one of the effects of it is it just makes you kind of boil from the inside. Oh. But eventually, they got the contraction stopped, they got the bleeding stopped, they put me in a hospital room, and they said, get to 24 weeks, because that's the limit.
So 4 more weeks.
Yeah. It was almost like they drawn a line in the sand. Like, you must get to 24 or there's no hope.
And why 24? What's special about that number?
They told me that 24 weeks is kind of the loose definition of viability. That sort of grew out of when they were fighting out Roe v. Wade.
In Fondren versus State, for example, the court ruled that a woman who commits an abortion on herself is guilty of no crime.
Okay, so here's the story as I understand it, Robert.
Okay.
In Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court was trying to strike this balance. They wanted to protect a woman's right to choose, as we know.
Right.
But they also wanted to say that there are limits to that right, that there is some moment in the development of the fetus, in the course of this pregnancy, where you cross this line and suddenly it's no longer just about the woman's rights. Now you have to think about the state's interest in the unborn child.
The problem, of course, is where do you draw that line?
Now that is the million-dollar question.
This is Nita Farahani. She's a law professor at Duke University.
So the kind of best guess at that point, the best medical objective standard that the justices could come up with,
and this is in 1973,
was viability.
And the word viable in this case means, can it survive on its own?
Yes, outside of the woman's womb.
In other words, when a fetus is developed enough that you can take it out of the mother's womb and it can still survive, that, the court suggested, is the point when it is no longer okay to have an abortion.
Because across that line, a fetus
is,
quote,
viable.
So then the question was, when does a fetus cross that line? When can it survive on its own?
Well, we begin, Mr. Justice, in our brief, with the development of the human embryo.
And here's where you get to the 24-week thing. What ended up happening was that the court considered what was known about fetal development. And there are charts that show this. Go like this. 3 weeks.
The fetus's brain and heart begin to develop.
8 weeks, nerve fibers.
13 to 16 weeks, the fetus begins to move and then kick.
At 23 weeks, some fetuses respond to familiar sounds, like a mother's voice.
And at 24 weeks...
air sacs form in the lungs. And the thinking was, maybe that's the point, the minimum point, where the fetus is viable, because perhaps it could breathe on its own. But this was just a theoretical idea. No one was testing it.
No one was trying to take the fetus out of a mother at 24 weeks to see if it would survive.
In fact, throughout the 70s and 80s, most hospitals, according to Kelly, drew the line of viability back a little bit farther. 28 weeks.
And that is because somewhere around the 28th week of gestation, the lungs start to produce a fluid called surfactant, which prevents the lungs from collapsing and sticking together between breaths. So that's a really important thing.
So for a long time, the actual viability line, not the theoretical one, was 28 weeks. But then in the late 70s,
someone invented an artificial lung surfactant. It's kind of a slippery white stuff that they shoot down the ventilator tube when the baby's born.
And that,
combined with IV nutrition,
new super small ventilators,
moved the line of viability back to around where it is now.
Where it is now is generally around 24, but here's the thing. Depending on what hospital you're in, even what doctor is on call, sometimes it can be 23 or 25, or in some cases, 22.
So given modern technology,
you could imagine, says Nita, one day the line could jump way back, which will make things really tricky.
If, for example, we get to the point where modern science is able to develop an artificial womb, does viability start at the point of a fertilized egg? You know, if the standard is the point at which the developing child can actually survive outside of the womb using any technological intervention possible, that is a slippery line indeed.
They said, get to 24 weeks, because that's the limit.
Which meant that the doctors had to pump Kelly full of drugs, keep her feet elevated for at least another 4 weeks.
But I just kept going into labor in and out of it, and they felt like they couldn't hold it off anymore.
And at 23 weeks and 4 days, a doctor tells her that there's nothing more they can do. The baby is going to come in a day, maybe two.
The guy comes in, and he seemed a little uncomfortable, like this was not pleasant for him. He said, you know, your baby's probably coming in 24 to 48 hours, and we know how hard you work to have this baby, and we know how much you want this baby, and we assume that you want everything done. What does that mean? We had no idea. So we said, we're not sure if we do want everything done. Paint the picture for us, doctor. And he said, you know, there's about a 53% chance that the baby will die no matter what we do.
53?
Yeah.
Whatever we do.
Whatever we do. There was a small chance that she could be fine.
What were those chances?
About 20.
Hmm.
I felt like 20%. you know, it's not an impossibility. It seems like a reasonable, it seems like worth a gamble until you really think about what the 80% means. I mean, she could be on a ventilator for the rest of her life. She could have a massive bleed in her brain, and it would like eat holes in her brain and affect her ability to think or talk or walk. She could be blind or deaf, and there was no way for the doctors to predict.
But what the doctors did know is that when the baby came into the world, it would need a ton of medical support. It may even need to be revived. And so the question for Tom and Kelly was, do they want the doctors to do that? Do they want them to pursue every measure possible, or no? And just let nature take its course.
And he said it would be, we should decide before the baby came, because once the baby came, if we saw the baby, it would be really hard to say no. Yeah. So if no was going to be the answer, we needed to say that before the baby came.
That was the worst night ever. Yeah, you're trying to make up your mind about what's right.
Like, would we be torturing this baby for nothing?
We didn't want her to be born and have a life that she would hate us for having.
There have been instances where children with birth defects or genetic diseases have filed wrongful life suits, essentially claiming that they should have never been born.
We had to really debate what was in her best interest. What would she want?
I started to really struggle with whether I was being selfish, whether I had already pushed too far. And this was like God or the universe pushing back. That we would end up losing our house, our marriage might break up, we would lose our ability to try again for another child. I felt like I might get a baby, but I would lose everything else.
And
I think I got pretty close to no.
All night as we're talking this through and crying and trying to figure it out, we could hear the baby's heartbeat through the monitor. Baby was letting us know all night, I'm right here. Right here.
But there must have been a moment where you had to say yes or no out loud.
Well, we asked for a second opinion, or not a second opinion, but another consult. We had some more questions. And a nurse practitioner from the NICU came to the room.
Yes, my name is Diane Loisel. I'm a neonatal nurse practitioner.
This is the next day.
They had asked to speak to someone again.
And instead of just citing numbers and statistics,
I don't give numbers. It's different for each baby.
She kind of started to paint a picture. This is what I've seen. I've been doing this 30 years.
But more importantly,
I also told them that it wasn't a yes or no decision.
She said, you know, you don't have to decide right now.
They could have the baby.
If the baby came out crying and active, then we should do everything.
We can.
For the baby.
But if the baby came out
blue and limp,
intraventricular hemorrhage, we could stop. We didn't have to keep going.
If something goes horribly wrong, we can withdraw the support, and then you can hold your baby until it dies. But you can give your baby a chance and see how it goes.
In other words, in a very real way, they could give this decision to the baby.
That same night, I was feeling like just uncomfortable.
A couple hours later, discomfort turns to pain.
Finally, a doctor came in and was like, yeah, you're in labor and we have to go right now. So then it was like super, super quick. OR, light, shot in the spine, cutting me open. And then, oh my God, there's a third person in this room. But not really, not quite almost. I mean, she was so, so early.
What did she look like?
Well, I didn't see her then. I just saw like her kind of whiz by in an incubator. And she just looked like a little dark smear in a hat.
And did you make it to 24 weeks?
So we were one day shy of 24.
23 weeks and 6 days.
If you'd like to see more of this story that you've been listening to, we've actually made a short film, which you can find at radiolab.org/23weeks. That's the number 23, radiolab.org/23weeks. And I would suggest that you wait till you finish listening, though, because the film does contain spoilers.
We'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, this is Kelly French.
This is Tom French, leaving the credit.
Here we go.
Okay, here we go. I'll try it. Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation
and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
Hi, this is Diane Loisel. More information about Sloan can be found at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is produced at WNYC
and distributed by NPR.